Hey, good morning. Doesn't the sanctuary just look awesome? If you haven't been here in a couple weeks, with all the gifts up here, I love it. It looks really cool. Awesome festive look. And thanks to those who did all this. Everyone who helped with these decorations and other decorations, all as someone who's just a volunteer, came and just served that way. So thank you so much for those who helped out. It looks awesome. Okay, so we're going to jump into our message. Today is our last one in our series we've been going through called Working 9 to 5, Our Work, God's Glory. And we've been going through this and talking about basically how our faith and our work integrate and that God has a design and purpose for our work. Well, I got a chance a couple of weeks ago to go down and visit someone in downtown Seattle. Went out for coffee with them. And then afterwards, they said, hey, can I give you a tour of my office? And I was like, that'd be awesome. So they're down in South Lake Union down there. And so went in over their office and got a tour, walking around, took me up to the 21st floor. And how many of you have been down to the South Lake Union area like in the last year? Yeah, if you haven't, construction is blowing up. It is unbelievable. I mean, there's cranes and buildings going up all over down there. And so as I stood up there on the 21st floor, looking down, the cool thing is that being up that high is that when you're down the street level, you know, walking by most construction zones, either, you know, you can barely see anything or they put that tarp around it, you know, so you can't see inside much. But being up so high, the beauty was I was looking right down and they were building a building right next to this person's building I was visiting. And so I could see down and it was just at the start. So you could see down, they were probably five stories below the earth, building all the stuff at the bottom of it. And so I could see all the things that weren't visible that if you're walking on the street that you would not be able to see. If you're walking on the street, maybe through some of the holes they provide or maybe a torn tarp, you could see some of the work that was going on. But you couldn't see all the work that was happening underneath. You couldn't see they were laying cables down there and they had different pipes that were going in. They were laying cement, all this different stuff. Basically, when I looked down, what I saw was the work under the work, was the work under the work. And I think you find the same thing to be true in our work. You find work under our work. John Eldridge, if some of you have heard of him, he's a well-known author for men. He wrote a book a number of years ago called Wild at Heart. Some of you have probably read that book. It's a great book for men. And in that book, he talks about as an adult, he was a very driven man. If people on the outside saw him, you would think he's a very focused person. He's a very driven person. He has someone who's full of purpose. And they saw that. And as he began to reflect on his life when he was in his 30s and 40s, and thinking about this drivenness nature of him, he began to ask the question, why? And he began to realize that perhaps there was some work under his work. And as he thought back, he realized that when he was 12 years old, the first part of his life from 0 to 12, his father was pretty present, and his father was pretty active. But for some reason, he wasn't quite sure. At the age of around 12, his dad became absent. He talked about how his dad really checked out. He said that from that point on, his dad largely would go out to his workshop alone behind their house, and he would spend the majority of his time doing crossword puzzles, reading, and drinking heavily. And so for the remainder of his teenage years, he basically had an absent dad who wasn't really there for him. And at that time is such a crucial time for a young man, right, who's looking for a father to show him what it means to be a man. He wanted to be affirmed as a man. He wanted to be loved as a young boy, and he didn't find those things. And so he wound up getting into a lot of trouble. When he was a young teenager, he was pretty rebellious, he said. He wound up getting kicked out of school, and he earned himself a police record. And all this time was all this stuff happening. Well, he met Christ when he was 19 years old. And he said that certainly changed his life, but it didn't deal with this sort of wound that came from his father. And so as he began going out in the world and he began working and he became an author and he became a speaker and he became a leader and he became very successful and very driven and all of this, but he began to realize there was a work under his work. He admitted the reason he was so driven, the reason he was going so hard, because he wanted to prove to everyone. He wanted to prove his manhood. He wanted to prove his affirmation. He wanted to prove to people that I can do it. I have what it takes. which he said is what every young boy wants to prove to people. I have what it takes. And so here he is working and doing all this stuff, and yet what you find is there is work under his work. There is the exterior work, but the interior work is what really drove everything. So my question to you at the beginning is, what is the work under your work? Last week, if you weren't here, we talked about how the gospel gives us a new story for our work, and it gives us a new conception for our work. This week, we're going to talk about how the gospel gives us a new passion for our work and a new ethical foundation for our work. You know, maybe as you're thinking about this right now, as the work under your work, maybe it's the fact that you're trying to avoid dealing with something, and so you pour yourself into work, right? I know some of us are guilty of that. It looks as though we're passionate about our work and we care about our work, but the reality is deep down we're simply avoiding something we don't want to have to deal with. Maybe it's my drive for significance, my drive for importance, my drive for my value, my drive for my work or my worth or my importance, all those things. Maybe that's what's really behind my work. It's the work under my work. You really see this in regards to passion. I just used the word passion a minute ago. You know, and we talk about people who are passionate about their work, or I have a lot of passion for what I'm doing in my work, no matter what that work is. But if you think about it, passion really can be fueled by different things. Simply just talking about your work is passionate, it can be fueled by different things. It can be fueled by a fear of failure, right? Sometimes our drivenness and passion and work, actually, the work under that is a fear of failure. I fear if I really go out and I really try and I really take on this thing and I do what I'm hoping to do, what if I fail? Then that means I'm a failure. So I'm driven for that. My identity in that case becomes rooted in my performance and what I have to do and not in Christ. Sometimes people are passionate too in their work to approve something, like I said with John Ulrich, right? And I've shared before my story a little bit when I was in junior in high school. And my basketball, and how I was teased and made fun of by my basketball coach, and I was bullied for a whole year by my basketball coach, and how much that really affected me. And I mentioned to you that at the end of that whole season, and how much that had done to me, that I was filled with two things, and it was both anger. I was incredibly angry at the coach, and also shame. I was so ashamed that I let someone take advantage of me like that. And really, the word that I would use to describe myself or what was happening was weak. I felt incredibly weak. And I remember at that point when I finished that season and I went on to the next year, I said to myself inside, I never verbally told anyone this, but I said inside to myself, I will never let anybody treat me weak again. I will never let anyone take advantage of me again. And so I did that. Anyone who said things to me that I interpreted as being demeaning, or you were trying to take advantage of me in some way, even if you weren't, that's what filter I saw it through. And the whole premise I had in my life was, I've got to prove to people that I'm not weak. And so if you looked on the outside of me, you probably saw a person who was good at a number of things. I was successful at my job, maybe with my family and those things. But inside, it was the work under my work. It was, I've got to prove it to people. Like I said, these passions appear noble on the outside and worthwhile, but we know as Christians and followers of Christ that we could call these counterfeit passions. Counterfeit passions, the work under our work. Dorothy Sayers, an author, in her book, Creed or Chaos, talks about these counterfeit passions. And she kind of categorized them in the context of the seven deadly sins. She sort of put them in that framework. And the one that she really focused on a lot in her research of these was sloth. Sloth and the seven deadly sins. And you think about sloth when we hear that word, I think probably most of us think of the word lazy, right? We probably think of someone who's lazy. Well, what's interesting is Dorothy Sayers began to dive into the Greek and the Latin and the background of this word and what it originally meant. She discovered it had more to do with passion for self and also the ability to masquerade as busyness and hard work. This is how she defines sloth as she discovered it. Sloth is the sin which believes in nothing, cares for nothing, enjoys nothing, loves nothing, hates nothing, finds purpose in nothing, lives for nothing, and only remains alive because there is nothing for which it will die for. I want to read you another description she writes about this slothfulness. In the book I've been preaching on here, Timothy Keller, Every Good Endeavor, which this series is based off of, I want to read you this description she provides of sloth. She says, it is one of the favorite tricks of this sin to dissemble itself under a cover of a whiffling activity of work. We think that if we are busily rushing about and doing things, we cannot be suffering from sloth. Gluttony offers a world of dancing, dining, sports, and dashing very fast from place to place to gape at beauty spots. Covetousness rakes us out of the bed at an early hour in order that we may put pep and hustle into our business. Envy sets us to gossip and scandals, to writing cantankerous letters to the paper, and to the unearthing of secrets and scavenging of dustbins. Wrath provides very ingeniously the argument that the only fitting activity in a world so full of evildoers and evil demons is to curse loudly and incessantly whatever brute and blackguard made the world. While lust provides that round of dreary promiscuity that passes for bodily vigor. But these are all disguises for the empty heart and the empty brain and the empty soul of sloth. In the world, it calls itself tolerance, but in hell, it is called despair. This description of sloth that Dorothy Sayers points out really shows us at the core of these counterfeit passions, at the core of this work under our work, is really self. It is self-organized, self-created, and done to self. She says another part, this, without something bigger than yourself to work for, then all your work energy is actually fueled by one of the other six deadly sins. I love that phrase, without something bigger than yourself to work for. How many people in our world are working for something less than, or are simply working for themselves? So many people. They might be working for all kinds of different things that they would talk about or acknowledge or say, but the truth is they're simply working for themselves. And without working for something bigger than myself, I will always be a slave to my own self. It's helpful at this point to remember this. Everyone is a worshiper of something. No matter whether you acknowledge it or not, everyone worships something. We were created to be worshipers, and you cannot avoid it. Everyone worships something. God, of course, created us to worship Him and to follow Him, and knows that when we worship Him, we will be satisfied, and when we don't worship Him and anything else, we will be dissatisfied. So what do we do? How do we stop this working of the work under our work? That's a lot of works. How do we stop that, the work under our work? How do we have passion for God and for others and not just passion for ourselves and these counterfeit passions? Well, I think it certainly isn't that we just stop telling people to be selfish, right? It's not that simple. Or to tell people to just rest and not do all that work under your work. I think that that's impossible, though, and that's foolish advice to tell people that. Selfishness is replaced, I think, with selflessness, and our glory is replaced with God's glory when we allow the gospel to transform us, when we allow the gospel to change our hearts. That is what happens. So I want to give you an example of this. Romans 12:11, in there, Paul says, "Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord." Never be lacking in, you could say, passion. Passion for God, passion for His kingdom, passion for other people, passion for my work. Never be lacking in that. But what fuels this? What fuels this true passion, we would call? Not these other counterfeit passions, but the true passion. Well, I think Paul answers that 10 verses earlier in Romans 12:1, where he says this, "Therefore I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship." Notice the first part he says that there, in view of God's mercy. He says, in view of God's mercy, then do these things. In view of God's grace, then do these things. In view of the gospel, then do these things. But what is it, we got to ask, about God's mercy that would make you stop all the work under your work give up your personal desires and truly live out of God's supply. What is it about his mercy? I think the answer is simple. I think the answer is, in fact, one word, and the answer is Jesus. That is the answer. Jesus is the ultimate demonstration and embodiment of God's mercy. It's interesting, if you look up the word mercy, which I did, here is the definition I found right at the very beginning of the dictionary. Mercy is compassion or forgiveness shown towards someone whom it is within one's power to punish or harm. Compassion or forgiveness shown towards someone whom it is within one's power to punish or to harm. And if you think about that picture and you think about God, who had every right, who had every entitlement, who had every reason in the world to punish you and I, right, for our rejection, our turning away, our walking away from God, but in fact, what did he do? He punished his own son in our place. Isaiah 53, 4 through 6. I want to read this and just think of that picture when I read this. He says, "Surely he, Jesus, took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us have turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all." Isn't that an unbelievable picture? That is the picture of mercy. Jesus was so burning hot for you and me that he sacrificed himself for our good, for our joy, for our freedom, for our hope, for our eternity, for all of it. Jesus did that. Another verse in Romans 5:8 says, "But God demonstrates his own love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." It wasn't after you got your life cleaned up. It wasn't after you follow God. It was when you and I gave God the middle finger when he died for you. That is the kind of mercy he has for you. That is the kind of forgiveness he has for you. Why was Jesus suffering, though? Why was he doing all this? Why was he going to that extent? Well, John 17:9, Jesus says, For them, I sanctify myself. For them, I sanctify myself. The word sanctify here means to set apart for a particular purpose or a goal. It's like an athlete who pulls himself aside and sets himself apart for a particular event that he's training for. And then all of his work and all of his energy and all of his diet and all of his time and all of his exercise is going towards this one particular goal. He's sacrificing for it to meet it. And this is the same exact thing that's true of Jesus. He set himself apart for the goal of our salvation. He lost everything, emptied everything, left everything. And to think this was all done for us and not himself. He is our model. He is the one to look for when it comes to true passion. And here's the thing when you begin to understand it. When you finally rest inside in the finished work of Jesus on the cross, it will penetrate your heart. It will put your heart at rest. It will put your heart to be able to lay down. And it will stop the work under your work. When you see Jesus' passion for us, not a counterfeit passion, but a true passion, it shines this sort of spotlight on our souls. And it shines this spotlight on the reasons that we do a lot of things we do. And if you're like me, it shows my sinfulness, my selfishness, and all of the idols that I have inside of me. And at the same time, it also points me to Jesus' true passion, to want to be like him, to want to follow like him, to want to give up my life the same way that he gave up his for us. C.S. Lewis said this. He said, "You will never make a good impression on other people until you stop thinking about what impression you are making. Even in literature and art, no man who bothers about originality will ever be original. Whereas if you simply try to tell the truth without caring two pence how often it has been told before, you will, he says, 9 times out of 10, become original without ever having noticed it. He ends by saying, give up yourself and you will find your real self. Give up yourself and you will find your real self. Timothy Keller in his book right here ends this section talking about this by saying this, our work under our work. He says, you are adopted into God's family, so you already have your affirmation. You are justified in God's sight, so you have nothing to prove. You have been saved through a dying sacrifice, so you are free to be a living one. You are loved ceaselessly, so you can work tirelessly. If the gospel isn't the daily foundation I set my feet on, there will always be work under my work. If the gospel isn't the daily foundation I set my feet on, there will always be work under my work. Many of us have seen the movie The Chariots of Fire. Great movie. The two characters in there, Harold Abrams and Eric Liddell. And there's a scene in the movie when these two guys are getting prepped and ready for this huge race, the biggest race basically of their lives. And the hour before, Harold Abrams is in there and he's getting prepped and ready and he's talking to this guy about the race. But it turns into not just the race, but he begins to talk about what's going on inside of him. You could say he wasn't talking about the work, but he began talking about the work under the work. And he told this man how he, at one point, didn't even know exactly what he was running for, what he was chasing for, and that this race meant everything to him. And in fact, he said, quote, that this justifies my whole existence. That's in contrast to Eric Liddell, a man who had followed Christ, and at one point in the movie at this race he was coming to, found out that it was going to be on a Sunday and talked about that he would be willing to not even run in the race if he had to, and he was okay with that. And you have to ask yourself, why would a man who's been training for something his whole entire life and finds out he may not be able to do it be okay with that? And the answer is, there wasn't work under his work. There was rest under his work. Eric Liddell said at one point in the movie, his famous line, when I run, he says, I feel his pleasure. When I run, I feel God's pleasure. That's a man who is working out of rest, not his work. When your heart is finally at rest from your work under your work, you can work with true devotion and passion for God. You can work for others, and you can actually do the work God has called you to do for the sake of the work and not dealing with stuff inside your own heart. When God sets you free from this. The second part of this that I want to transition to then is not only does the gospel give you rest from under your work, but it gives you a new basis for ethics. A new basis for ethics. Have you ever done something in your work that you shouldn't have done? Something maybe perhaps that other people don't know about, but you know you shouldn't have done. Whether it's maybe you lied about something at your work, you compromised something, maybe you withheld certain information, maybe there's something, a choice that you know you should have made, but you didn't really make that choice. Back in 2010, or 2009 actually, when I was wrapping up my seminary, I was working at Mars Hill up on 35th up there, the old Mars Hill. And I was doing the last part of my seminary up there. I had a 9-month internship with them. And during the internship, my responsibility was to be working 10 hours a week working with their community groups. So I was helping their community groups pastor with all the work going on there. But at this time, in 2009, my wife and I were having our second child. And I was working full-time at the city of Bellevue and was super, super busy. And so there were many weeks that went by, and not that I put in 7 out of 10 hours, but I put in 0 out of 10 hours. There were weeks, and I would justify to myself, there's no way I can do this. I'm so busy with my two kids and my family and my work. I just can't do this. And I justified myself too. This was the last thing I had to do before being done with seminary. I've been going for 7 years. And I'm like, this is it. I'm not turning back. I put my family through a lot to get here myself. I am not turning back. And so the 9 month time ended, and I had to turn in all my stuff to the seminary and my timesheets throughout the week. And of course, I filled in. I did 10 hours every single week. And I passed. Everything was great. I graduated. Everything went well till about 2 months later when my wife and I are at home one day, and my oldest daughter decided to not tell us the truth about something. And so my wife and I went, my wife and I met with her, and we talked with her, and we sat down, and we told her about, or we asked her what happened, and she explained, and she confessed that she had lied, and we talked about how God wants us to be, you know, to be people of truth and telling the truth, and how, and just how important that is. And as I've explained that to her, I felt maybe a small tap on my shoulder. And God saying, John, do you know anybody that maybe needs to learn this same lesson? And I'm like, no, I can't think of anybody. And as I began to think about it, all I could hear was one word just screaming in my head, and that word was hypocrite. You're such a hypocrite. And I thought, what a total hypocrite I am. And so I called up the seminary, and I went in, and I won't tell you more, but I went in and basically confessed the whole thing to them and told them all about what happened. And it was great. They were really gracious to me, and they worked out a plan for me and how I could do that and make up for it and graduate. But, you know, there's those times that we look back and we're embarrassed about it, we're ashamed that we did something. But I think if we're all honest, right, I think we'd all have to say in our work, there are things that we have done that we should not have done. But I think we got to ask the question, though, why should I practice ethical behavior in the workplace? And I think Christians and non-Christians would likely share a number of common practices, right, about different things like honesty and integrity and fairness and being generous to people, all those kinds of things. But I think if you really look at it, though, around the reasons why most of the companies or schools or governments that we work for, and what really is the reason ultimately that they're being ethical or striving to be ethical, I think it comes from other motives oftentimes. I think what oftentimes comes from is either some sort of benefit to them that outweighs the cost. I think you hear things like it's good for business, or it's good for our standing in the community, or for long-term effectiveness, or it makes pragmatic sense for our company, or even it's the most moral thing to do. But the gospel gives us a much firmer foundation and true anchor for ethics in the workplace. We can know that having integrity and being honest and being generous and being truthful and being faithful are good in themselves, and we can seek God in all of it and make much of Him regardless of what's happening around us, regardless of having to navigate things in our company so that we look good. The gospel gives us a much firmer foundation for that. And the truth is that when we're people of that, when we're people of the gospel, and we're people who can have right motivations for our ethics, sometimes we will be exalted, and sometimes we will not. Sometimes you will suffer or lose out or be disadvantaged because of your stance on things and because of your ethics. Bruce Waltke, an author, says that when it comes to these kinds of things about being ethical and what happens in regards to being disadvantaged, he said, a righteous person is they that disadvantage themselves to advantage others, while the wicked are willing to disadvantage the community to advantage themselves. That's an interesting picture. And when I read that quote, I thought of one person, Jesus. Jesus. I thought of the verse in 2 Corinthians 8:9. It says this, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. Isn't that awesome? I will be disadvantaged for your advantage. That's the ethics of the kingdom. That's the ethics of Jesus. That's the ethics of the gospel. I shared, though, last sermon, if you weren't here, about this idea of common grace. If you remember last week, I talked about God's common grace, and that this common grace that God gives is this grace to all people, whether you believe in Jesus or not, and the fact that God has showered gifts to every person. He's given them gifts and skills and abilities and talents, and that therefore, as believers, we can work alongside those who don't share our faith with joy and with purpose and with mission, knowing that we can serve God, even that person may not acknowledge it, we know that God is there and that we can work towards common things in our world that God cares about. And so when it comes to this common grace, we're able to do that. But the question arises, and people oftentimes ask, do you need to be a Christian to be ethical? I think the answer is both yes and no. I think it's no in the sense that you can look at cultures all across the world and you can see them share common values or common ethics. C.S. Lewis, again, in one of his famous books called The Abolition of Man, if you read that one, the book is basically about looking at cultures across the world and identifying all these common things that they believe are good. Things like truthfulness, compassion, honesty, kindness, generosity, and love. And so you see all these things that to do those, you don't need to be a Christian. Again, I would say it's an example of common grace, common things God has put into each person. Do you need to be a Christian to practice these? Again, I would say no to a large degree. Because again, we talked about last week, God's put his image in every person, right? And even though that image has been marred by sin, everyone has his image inside of them. They have a recognition of what it looks like to be truthful, of what it looks like to have integrity, what it looks like to love people. And so people have that wired into them, although it's marred to a certain degree by sin. But on the other hand, can you be ethical and not be a Christian? The part of that I think, or excuse me, do you need to be a Christian to be ethical? The other part of it that, yes, you do, I think, is for two reasons. One is that our belief in and trust in God gives us a basis for ethics, as without God, there is no ultimate reason to be loving, kind, and truthful. Without God, there is no basis for ethics. The second reason is that in Christ and in becoming a Christian, is that God has given us a brand new heart inside, a heart that no longer serves myself but serves others in him, and he's also given us his Holy Spirit inside of us, which guides and leads us and directs us and gives us the power to live out the life that he calls us to. And if you don't have those two things, then you might have the desire to do right, you might have the knowledge to do right, but you don't have the ability to do right. That's what the Holy Spirit and a new heart gives you, are those things. The other part of this is that if you think about it, oftentimes people find the basis for their ethics in values or standards or a list of codes, right? But as I talked about here, for a Christian, it's so different because the reason for our ethics and what informs our ethics in the workplace is not a list of codes or practices or procedures or standards. It's a person. It's a person. It's a relationship with Jesus. That's what informs our ethics. That's what's underneath it all, is that Jesus and who he is informs how we're living out our lives. Okay, I want to talk about one of the ways that the gospel informs our ethics in the workplace. And one of these areas is human rights. Is human rights and how this plays out in the workplace. I want to talk about, first of all, again, because we have God's image inside of us, and everyone does, that gives everyone value. Everyone's life value, no matter their race, their gender, their identity, their moral character, their choices, no matter who they are, they have worth and value. Why? Because of God's image. Because God's image resides inside of them. And as I said a little bit before, if there is no God, there is no basis for human rights. You cannot argue for human rights without God. Because simply, how can accidental collections of chemicals and neurons firing about produce value in a person? They can't. Accidental neurons, chemicals floating around space to produce people, if that is true, those things can't give value to people. They can't give rights to people. So without God, you have no basis for human rights. And you know, this might sound normal to us today. I mean, we hear it all the time in the news, all the time in our workplaces. You talk to anybody in downtown Seattle, everyone talks about human rights. And so it seems normal in our culture. What you have to understand is that before Christianity came on the scene, this was not the case. In Roman culture and in Greek culture, they did not believe that. They did not believe that people had inherent value and worth. Worth and value was based on your abilities and gifting. That's why Aristotle famously said that he thought some people are born to be slaves. And we would be shocked at that now, of course. But in his time, he said that because they believed people did not have inherent worth and value, that some people are born with certain value and some aren't. And it's when Christianity came on the scene that that began to provide a foundation or a worldview for people to have inherent and a given rights and a given status. But how does that play itself out in the workplace? How does these human rights that we can buy into as believers in the gospel, how does that affect the workplace? Well, I want to just list out some reasons or some ways that this informs it. First, this. People are not a tool for you to use to get ahead. People are not a tool for you to use to get ahead. I think if we're honest, we oftentimes calculate and manipulate how we can use someone's talents and abilities to move upward in our companies. Do we not subtly assess people's strengths and weaknesses and then strategize how we can use those for our own ends? Do we not do that? And I would say today, perhaps some of us are even skilled in using other people for our own benefit. We basically play a chess game with people, moving them around on the board so that somehow we can win. People are not a tool for you to use in your workplace to get ahead. Secondly, people are not a resource to be used up. People are not a resource to be, it's especially a word for you out there who are managers or who are supervisor, who are business owners, who have the ability to allocate people and resources. People are not resources to be used up. I had a conversation with a friend back in 05 when he moved here and he got employed by a tech company here in Seattle. And as he began working for a couple of months, he told me about the work culture there. And the work culture, he said, is unbelievable. I mean, he said, people are literally bringing blankets in and sleeping in their offices at night. People are coming in at 6 in the morning and not leaving till late in the evening every single day. He said, the atmosphere here is basically churn you in or churn you up, work you around, and then you're out. He said, a turnover rate is so incredibly high because why? Because people were seen simply as a resource to be used up. And sadly, this even happens in the church. Of all places where it shouldn't happen, it happens. And churches see people as someone who can just pour into ministry, give to people, serve. And we forget it's a person with value and rights, not a resource or commodity for you to use up. Number three, we assess then, on the other hand, how we can cultivate and grow the latent potential in people. Since there are an image bearer of God and people, like we said, have skills, talents, abilities, gifts, and all this potential, we think about how we can develop people, encourage people, strengthen people, and foster their growth. That's what we should be doing. And do you do that in your workplace? Do you see the people in your workplace not as a person who can benefit you somehow, but as some person who you can pour into and develop in them? I mean, how different is it to see your coworkers, to look at them, to pray about them, and think about, man, this person has been created in God's image. Look at all the talents they have. How can I foster that? How can I cultivate that? How can I speak life into that person? That's a very different framework from how most of us do it. Okay, number four, no matter how disrespectful, dishonest, greedy, or selfish a person is, they have value and bear God's image. Right? Therefore, I should treat them with dignity, with value, respect, and compassion. How many of us have someone in our office or building or team, and we look at them and say, oh my gosh, that person is either such a loser, that person's a cheat, that person does this to other people. All of us probably have someone who we know, right? And it's so easy to look at that person and think less. But the gospel again reminds us that person has worth and value. And it gives us to God's heart on that person, right? I mean, isn't it so easy we start seeing them from a horizontal perspective? But then once we get God's heart, we see them from a vertical perspective and realize this person's loved the same way I'm loved. And the truth is, too, speaking of the gospel isn't just for those people. The gospel's for us. And although you might look at that person, you think, oh, they have all these problems. The reality is if God opened up any of our hearts and showed us what's inside any of us, we would have equally, maybe even more problems than that person. We all are in need of the gospel, not just those who are irreligious or who have all the visible issues. We all need the gospel. Okay, number five, we don't form work relationships just to get a benefit from someone else. This kind of ties into the first one I gave, but a little more specific. We don't form relationships to get a benefit out of someone. You know, what's interesting, a couple of weeks ago, I was at a lunch with a number of pastors and leaders, and we were talking about these partnerships that we're forming with schools, the one I just talked about earlier, and which actually, as a church, on a side note, we're hoping to foster and to build more our partnership with a local school here. But anyways, we were talking about these partnerships and forming them and how we're doing it and different things that we can serve. And one guy raised his hand in there in the middle of the meeting and said, "Hey, I have a question for you guys." He said, "Especially you pastors." He said, "The comment I hear from a lot of people at our church in the way that we partner with this school is, we're giving all this money to this school, we're giving all this effort to this school, we're doing all this school, but what's in it for us? What are we getting back as a church?" He said, "Because a lot of these people that we're serving at the school, I don't see them coming to our church. So what benefit it is for us?" And it was kind of a silent moment there. All of us sat in the room. And we just thought, how turning a relationship, how turning blessing people and serving people comes about so I form relationships so it can benefit me. And is this not, I think, one of the most prominent things in a workplace? It is so common for people to think about how I can form relationships so I can somehow get a benefit, how it can come back to me and benefit me, whether financially benefit me, whether I form better relationships, whether a certain deal in my business, how I can do this. And just to clarify, I'm not saying you never form relationships so there can be some business connection. That's not what I'm saying. That's just wise work, I think. I'm saying forming relationships simply so that you can get a benefit out of it, which is, in essence, is using a person. Again, I think what's helpful here is going back to the gospel as we keep doing and to ask ourselves, did Jesus get a benefit in what he did for us? And the answer is simply, I think, no. In fact, it's the opposite. Jesus came to serve and save us, and he did it because he lost everything. He gave up everything, and he became a curse to God, right? Jesus didn't come to save us to get a benefit. He came to lose. Should not that be our posture then? That we don't go to people to simply get a benefit. And the last thing is this, is helping people connect the dots between their desire to help others and having compassion and being honest, all these sorts of things, and having integrity and tie it to God's image in them. Right? I mean, we're working with people all the time who we know, again, because of common grace. They have skills, abilities, all these things. And understanding this, we can help them tie it together and to recognize all the things that you have and that you're working for, all these things are really God's image inside of you. It's really living out all that stuff. Okay, the second thing, I'll say this and we're going to wrap up in a minute, is the gospel gives us a right audience for ethics. The gospel informs our view on human rights in the workplace, but then it also gives us the right audience for ethics. Ephesians 6, 5 through 8, Paul says this. He says, "Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Obey them not only to win their favor when their eye is on you, but as slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. Serve wholeheartedly as if you were serving the Lord, not men, because you know that the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good they do, whether they are slave or free." It's an audience of one. It's an audience of one to inform our ethics and the way we work. Paul says right there in that passage, you're not serving the person master over, you're serving Jesus himself. I read a quote this week that says, "Only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last." Carson Wentz, some of you guys know, he's the quarterback for the Philadelphia Eagles. I bring him up partly because the Seahawks beat the Eagles about 2 weeks ago, right? Yep. So Carson Wentz, he's the quarterback for the Philadelphia Eagles, found out this week that on his wrist he has the words tattooed A-O-1, which stands for an audience of one. And he tattooed that on his wrist, and he actually has a website he has where he has devoted all this stuff to living his life for an audience of one. He is a Christ follower, and he wants to do that. And so he talks about how he put that tattoo because everywhere he goes, he wants to be reminded that he is serving an audience of one. On his website, he says, "Whether it's playing football, going to school, or whatever I'm doing it for the Lord as my audience." This audience affects his ethics all over the place, and especially his work out on the football field. It's an audience of one.
Everyone is working for an audience. Again, everyone's a worshiper. Everyone works for an audience. You either work for your supervisor, you work for a friend, you work for a parent, you work for a spouse, you work for your kids, or you work for you. You work for someone. Every single one of us works for someone. The question is, who do you work for? Who is your audience? I want to talk about the passage just really quickly. And one of the things I know that stands out, that is there, is this sense of slavery. And I want to say quickly, we don't have time to dive into this today. This is not a sermon about the context of that passage. I do want to say, though, that just briefly, that the slavery that's being talked about, Paul, in here is radically different from the conception of slavery we have today. So I just urge you not to take a modern conception of slavery and place it on the text, but in fact understand the Roman culture and the Roman time and what slavery meant, and just enough to say it was radically different from our understanding of what we have of slavery today. But that said, in verse 5 there, Paul calls slaves to obey their earthly masters, he says, just as you would obey Christ. In other words, it's not his master he's serving, but Jesus. So what are some of the implications of this? Well, in verse 6, he says that you work not only when their eye is on you, but when their eye is not on you. He says in verse 7 to work wholeheartedly, meaning with all your body, mind, and soul. This means, of course, that your work should not be to put in the minimum of what's required of you. It's not simply coming to work and just putting in the bare minimum. He's saying work wholeheartedly. Work with everything in you, giving all you have to give. Because he says we're not working for people, but for the Lord. Another verse that says the same thing as Colossians 3, 23 through 24. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord, from him. If you have an audience of one, if you have an audience of Christ, what would change at your work? What would change in how you turn in reports? How about how you handle meetings? Would your work ethic change? Are there things that you would stop doing? Are there things you would start doing? Are there things at work you're involved in that no one knows about, but you know you shouldn't be doing? An audience of one affects how we work. I read a story about a woman who came to a church over on the East Coast. And the pastor that was there, and every time after service, she would dart out right after the service is over. And this happened multiple times. And the pastor every time was like, I got to get back there and catch her and find out what's her story. And so one day he did. He was able to go back, and he caught her before she was able to leave. And he said, hey, I just wanted to say hello. I just want to tell you thanks for coming here. And then he said, hey, how did you hear about our church? And she said, oh, yeah, that's a pretty amazing story. I should tell you how I heard about your church. And she said, I want to tell you first that I'm not a Christian. She says, but I'm looking seriously at it. And she said, but here's how I came to your church. She said, so I work for a company here in the city. And she said, I was working on this big project in my office. And she said, I made this huge mistake. I messed up this major component in this project. And it was a big project, and I thought that I would likely be fired because of this mistake I made. And my boss knew about this mistake. She said, but what happened was actually my boss went into his boss's office and he took full responsibility for my mistake. And she said, I went into his office later in that day and I went in and I first said, thank you, I can't believe that you did that. And she said, you know, all the supervisors I've ever had in my office here have always done the opposite. They've taken credit for things that I did and acted as though they had done it. She said, I've never had a supervisor take the blame for something that they never did. And she says, why did you do that? Why did you take the blame for me for something you didn't even do? And she asked him, and he kept trying to dismiss it and being like, oh, it wasn't a big deal. You know. And she's like, no, seriously, why did you do that for me? Why did you do that? And eventually he finally said, okay, I'll tell you why. And this is what he said. This is what she told him. He said, I'm a Christian. That means, among other things, that God accepts me because Jesus Christ took the blame for things that I had done wrong. He did that on the cross. That is why I have a desire and sometimes the ability to take the blame for others. Her next question, what church do you go to? his understanding of living out the gospel and of the gospel affecting his ethics and the way he handled his work not only transformed his ethics, but transformed a woman's life who later became a Christian. And it was that man living out the gospel in his work that changed her life. How different would your life look with an audience of one? You know, I want to end today, and we've been going through this whole entire series, briefly, quickly sharing about me and my story. And when I was young, I grew up in a family that was Christian. Both my parents were Christians, and we were part of a church. And my parents were awesome. They did a really good job with us, I think, with our faith. But I didn't become a Christian until after my freshman year of college. And one of the big reasons I didn't want to become a Christian, and one of the big reasons I constantly struggled with, was how the gospel, how Christianity affected real life. What I oftentimes saw and what I oftentimes struggled with is that those around me who were Christians, that they had this sort of Christian life in the church, or they had this sort of subculture where they lived out this life with God, but I couldn't see how it impacted real life. I couldn't see what it had to do with dating. I couldn't see what it had to do with my school. I couldn't see what it had to do with my sports. I couldn't see what it had to do with my money. I couldn't see what it had to do with my friends. I couldn't see what it had to do with anything that actually mattered in life. It was this sort of thing that was not relevant over in this subculture. And it wasn't until after freshman year that I began to be around some people who really helped me integrate and understand how the gospel, how Jesus, how Christianity informs, in fact, everything in life. And it really feeds and permeates and transforms everything. And when I saw that, that was really the thing that changed my heart. And God got my heart, and I decided to follow Jesus. And the big thing that I want to pull away from this whole entire series is the gospel informs our work. I hope today when you walk out of here that for the entire series that you understand that it's not just coming to a service on Sunday like this and then Monday morning you just live like everyone else, right? The gospel informs our work. It shapes our work. It permeates our work. And you have a place you're going to 5 days a week, 40 plus hours, where you have an opportunity to make a tremendous difference. And so let's let the gospel permeate everything in our lives. I'm going to leave you with this quote by Abraham Kuyper. He says this, "There is not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine." Let's pray. Dear Jesus, this has been an amazing series. I know amazing for me and for, I hope, others to see just how transformative that you are, Lord, and the amazing work and the amazing plans you have for our work, God. And today, as we're talking, God, I know that some of us are probably thinking about the work under our work. And we're thinking about our daily jobs, and maybe everyone around us sees us, and they think, man, that person's such a great job. They've got so many gifts and skills, and I love their work. But if we're honest, we know deep down there is all kinds of work that we're trying to do to make the other work work. And God, for that person today, Father, I just ask that they would be able to come to you and they would clearly see the gospel, they would clearly see Jesus, what you have done for them, and that they can finally stop. They can finally rest. They can finally stop all the work of trying to do all these things to get people's approval or to try and be important or to find value in their lives or to run from something in their past. They can just stop, Lord, and they can know that they are a son or a daughter of you, that they've been loved so they don't have to try and be loved, that they're enough in you so they can stop trying to be enough. They've been proven right because of your death so they can stop trying to prove that to other people. Lord God, give us rest from our work, deep rest, soul rest. And God, would you help that inform the way that we live out our days at our offices. Let us not just do the right things because everyone else is doing them. Let us do them because of how you've changed our hearts. And let us live out these things of not just being good at work or making the right choices, but sacrificially loving the people around us. Let us live gospel-centered lives that radiate not morality, but radiate Jesus. Let people in our work see this, Lord God. Transform our hearts, God. Do the work you got to do in us, Lord. Please do it. We need you. We are incapable without it. We stand here today, God, and ask you to do a work in us, God. Do a work through us, Lord. In your name, Jesus. Amen. Let's continue worshiping.